This is the second day of this January 2008 Rohatsu Sesshin. We'll resume reading from the autobiography of Zen Master Hanshan. And this, by the way, appears in the book called The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. Some of you may be familiar with the famous 7th century Chinese poet Hanshan. This is 16th century. It's not, although he did poetry, he wasn't the real famous poet by the same name from much earlier. We left off yesterday with Hanshan having had enlightenment, and his pal Miao Feng, brother monk, seeing him and being delighted and saying, "What have you found?" And Hanshan said, "Last evening I saw two iron oxen fighting with each other. Along the riverbank until they both fell into the water. Since then, I've not heard anything of them." And then Miao Feng congratulated him. And then he continues, "Soon after this, Zen Master Fa Kuang, whom I had long greatly admired, also came. I was pleased to have this opportunity to meet and train under him. After we had exchanged a few words, I was very impressed and begged him for instruction. He told me that I should work on Zen by dissociating from mind, consciousness, and perceptions, and also that I should keep away from both the holy and the mundane paths of learning." Just a pause here. Dissociating. I don't know about that translation, but anyway, not being engaged with the mind, the stuff of the mind, thought forms and fantasies, and not being involved in consciousness or in perceptions. This may sound strange to some people, I don't know. But we do this when we are absorbed in our practice. We are, I suppose, dissociating from mind, consciousness, and perceptions. In other words, we are dwelling in no mind, which is beyond mind, consciousness, and perceptions, but not separate from it. That's the paradox that talking about Zen, it always comes down to paradox when we're using words. We have consciousness. This is one of our human endowments. Mind and perceptions. Yeah, this is all within our functioning, and it's not separate from this realm of no mind, but they're also not exactly the same. When we're absorbed in mu, for example, or breath, it doesn't matter. Let's say mu. When you're absorbed in mu, you are in a realm that is beyond the ordinary functioning of the mind, the discriminating mind and discriminating consciousness. And even perceptions don't are experienced in the same way, because you don't, there's just the pure direct hearing itself, the pure seeing itself without thoughts about it. This is really a rare experience, is just the sound, let's say, of the train. Just the sound, no thoughts about it, no associations. no memories, but just the pure perception, the pure hearing. Same with sight, same with taste and all the senses, same with thought. A thought comes to mind, just that simple experience of a thought is not what causes us so much trouble in our sitting. It's embroidering on those thoughts, setting off and piling more thoughts on top of that first thought. This is what leads us astray. But just a simple thought floating through the mind. These are just like little snowflakes. They're really quite harmless if we don't attach to them, if we don't cling to these. Then, if we do, then that's what builds up, karma. So, he told me that I should work on Zen by dissociating from mind, consciousness, and perceptions, and also that I should keep away from both the holy and the mundane paths of learning. Well, this is Zen advice at its purest. Is you don't need to, it's not about learning anything. It's unlearning. Emptying the mind so that we can apprehend reality purely, directly, unmediated by thought, unmediated by learning, knowledge, facts. I benefited greatly by his instructions. When he talked, his voice was like the throbbing of a heavenly drum. I then realized that the speech and behavior of those who actually understood the truth of mind are quite different from the speech and behavior of ordinary people. One day, after reading some of my poems, Master Fa Kuang sighed. This is really beautiful poetry. Where else can one find such wonderful lines? Yes, these poems are good, but one hole still remains unopened, he laughed. I asked Master, have you opened that hole yet? He replied, for the past 30 years I have trapped tigers and caught dragons, but today a rabbit came out of the grass and frightened me to death. I said, Master, you are not the one who can trap tigers and catch dragons. The master raised his staff and was about to strike me when I snatched it and grabbed his long beard, saying, you said it was a rabbit, but actually it was a frog. The master then laughed and let me go. Tigers and dragons are metaphors, are very much admired in Zen. Tigers being someone of great energy and courage. Dragons symbolize enlightened ones. One day the master said to me, it is not necessary for you to go away far to seek a Zen teacher. I hope you will stay with this old man so that we can work together on subduing the ox. I said to him, your wit, eloquence, and understanding of Buddhism. It's interesting, he says wit first. Maybe he's using in the old sense of intelligence. Anyway, your wit, eloquence, and understanding of Buddhism are in no way inferior to that of Dawi. Dawi is a great great Chinese master, predecessor of these two, who is credited with the greatest reform of Lin Qi Zen, Rinzai Zen, until Hakuin in Japan centuries later. We've often read from the teachings of Dawi. Swampland Flowers is the book I'm referring to. Are in no way inferior to that of Dawi. However, there are some peculiarities in your manner that puzzle me. I am conscious that your hands are always waving and your mouth constantly murmuring as if reading or chanting something. In short, your manner seems rather like that of a lunatic. What is the reason for this? Master Fa Kuang replied. Before we get to his reply, a comment on this. I think a lot of people have a certain picture of what an enlightened person is, the way an enlightened person should be. I suppose a very common image of that is someone who is utterly masterful in all his or her actions, perfectly balanced, poised, dynamic, and so forth. But the truth is that enlightenment doesn't make you all these things, that you can have a direct insight into the nature of reality and have plenty of peculiarities, not to mention just plain old bad habits from before the Enlightenment. These things don't go away with enlightenment. Some of them are sort of scrubbed away in the years or decades of practice after enlightenment. But there are plenty of idiosyncrasies and eccentricities that enlightened people can have. I remember when I first got to the center once, I was walking down Arnold Park, and about maybe 100 feet ahead of me, Roshi Kaplow was going down the sidewalk. And that's the first time I noticed that he had a kind of a way of walking where his hands were very loose and sort of flopping around, his arms. I can't do it because I'm sitting down. Otherwise, I'd be glad to imitate it. But then, you know, and then I remember the time, well, gee, how can an enlightened person be have anything other than a perfectly graceful walk? I brought it up with one of my sisters, and I said, guys, looked a little like a puppet walking in that respect. His gait was beautifully smooth and all, but there was a little thing he did with his arms that threw me at first. And then that's part of the process of getting to know a teacher, is to see these peculiarities and not to mention just imperfections and all. And then you just stop. You let go of your notions about how an enlightened person should be or act or anything, and you just see that there's great diversity, great range and variety of personalities. But at first, it can be quite puzzling, as Hanshan seemed to be here with this. So he says, in short, your manner seems rather like that of a lunatic. What is the reason for this? He said. Fa Kuang replied, this is my Zen sickness. When the enlightenment experience came for the first time, automatically and instantaneously, poems and stanzas poured from my mouth like a gushing river flowing day and night without ceasing. I couldn't stop, and since then I have had this Zen sickness. I asked, what can one do when it first appears? He said, when this Zen sickness first appears, one should notice it immediately. If he doesn't recognize it, a Zen master should correct it for him at once by striking him severely and beating it out of him. Then the master should put him to sleep. When he awakes, he will be over the sickness. I regret to say that my master was not alert and severe enough to beat it out of me at that time. Hanshan then continues, in 1575, I was 30 years old. With Miao Feng, I went to Wutai Mountain. Wutai Mountain, Wutai Shan, is the most famous pilgrimage site in China. Wutai means a five-terrace mountain. And it was the closest thing in ancient China, closest thing there was to a center, a national center of vigorous Zen Chan practice and training. When I visited there in 1985, it was just a shell of what it had been. We visited some old decrepit temples, uninhabited temples, and learned that during the Tang Dynasty, Wutai Shan, there were 800 temples on Wutai Shan. And then at the time of the Cultural Revolution, when it began there in 1966, there were something like 300 left. And then at that time, when I was there, there were just 75 of them left. And we only saw a handful that had anyone in them at all. But there are koans that mention Wutai Shan. The famous one of the old woman at the fork of the road, who, when asked by the monks what is the way to Wutai Shan, she would say, straight ahead. Just go straight ahead. Go with an undivided mind. It wasn't until I went to Wutai Shan that I saw that there was this real twist to what she was saying, because the bus that took us the last 6 hours to Wutai Shan was on a snaking road. It was the most, other than the road from Oaxaca to Puerto Angel or Puerto Escondido, it was about the most snaky, curvy road I've ever been on. And here she would stand there and say, go straight ahead. So Miao Feng and I went to Wutai Mountain. We stayed at Lung Men on the north side. On the 3rd of March, we cleared the snow from an old house and took residence there. Ranges of mountains completely covered with snow and ice surrounded our abode. This was the place I had dreamed of for a long, long time. I felt as happy as if I had entered into a heavenly paradise. Both mind and body felt at ease and comfortable. I can't resist saying that's how I feel when I'm in Sichin in Mexico at Tapalewi. Goes on here. After some time, Miao Feng went to such and such a place while I remained alone. I fixed my mind upon one thought and spoke to no one. If anyone came to the door, I merely looked at him and said nothing. After a while, whenever I looked at people, they appeared like dead logs. My mind entered a state in which I could not recognize a single word. At the start of this meditation, when I heard the howling of the storms and the sounds of the ice grinding against the mountains, I felt disturbed. The tumult seemed as great as that of thousands of soldiers and horses in battle. Later, I asked Miao Feng about it. He said, "All feelings and sensations arise from one's own mind. They do not come from outside." Have you heard what the monks in the old days said? If one doesn't allow his mind to stir when he hears the sound of flowing water for 30 years, he will come to the realization of the miraculous understanding of Avalokiteshvara. Let me stop here, and since we are, we do have Makyo season ahead of us in the next day or two, starting in the next day or two, all feelings and sensations arise from one's own mind. They do not come from outside. This is the key thing to remember when you're beset with fears or images or hallucinations, is that this is just your own mind that you're seeing. He continues, "I then went to sit on a solitary wooden bridge and meditated there every day. At first, I heard the stream flowing very clearly, but as time passed, I could hear the sound only if I willed it. If I stirred my mind, I could hear it, but if I kept my mind still, I heard nothing." He's really describing here a form of samadhi, a deep state of absorption. "One day, while sitting on the bridge, I suddenly felt that I had no body. It had vanished, together with the sound around me. Since then, I have never been disturbed by any sound." There are people sometimes who come to Doksan early in Sesshin and complain about someone near them in the Zendo breathing too loudly or otherwise some kind of noise. And we do want people to refrain from breathing too loudly because it can be a disturbance to other people. But too loudly, it depends on how you define it. Sometimes, really, breathing within normal range can get on someone's nerves in Sesshin, and they can get all wigged out about it. And I tell such people, okay, the monitors, we have to rely on the monitors to determine whether it's out of line, if it's too loud. If not, then you'll find, if you keep sitting, that it won't disturb you anymore. And this always happens. I've never known anyone to go through a whole Sesshin and still be bothered by normal kinds of sounds. It seems to be a certain point in Sesshin when they become most vexing. That is, to the few people who still get vexed by these sounds. And then they become background noise, and they cease to be a problem. The important thing is to take responsibility for your own experience. that to a very great extent, our experience is determined by where we are directing our attention. If we're directing our attention at the sound and thinking about it and creating all kinds of stories about it, then it's going to be a problem. But if we, even while noticing it, if we just keep the attention riveted on our practice, the breath or the koan, then these sounds recede. You still may hear them, but they're not a disturbance anymore. And actually, it's the same with internal sounds, thoughts, or songs that are going through the mind. This is another experience many people have had, where they hear some song just replaying over and over again in the mind. And they can, at a certain point, they can be really bothered by it. But then as time goes on, it may still be there, cycling through the mind, but it's there, but it's not there. It's not a problem. We don't have to get rid of things for them to not be a problem. The most obvious example of that is thoughts. We don't have to get rid of thoughts. Whoever said we had to get rid of thoughts? We will always have thoughts flitting through the mind. If we don't attend to them, then they don't need to be a problem. It's all a question of where we're focused, where our attention is focused. And if it's on the practice, this, which really means if we're focused on this realm of no mind, then the commotions of the mind will not be a problem any more than external sounds. So he still, we'll go back here, he's still in this, on Wu Tai Shan and his solitary retreat. He says, my daily food was a gruel of bran, weeds, and rice water. Bran, weeds, and rice water. Bon appetit. When I first came to the mountain, someone had given me 3 pecks of rice, which lasted for more than 6 months. There's a footnote or something that said it's about 20 kilograms, so about 44 pounds of rice. It lasted him for 6 months. One day, after having my gruel, I took a walk. Suddenly, I stood still, filled with the realization that I had no body or mind. All I could see was one great illuminating whole, omnipresent, perfect, lucid, and serene. It was like an all-embracing mirror from which the mountains and rivers of the earth were projected as reflections. When I awoke from this experience, I felt as clear and transparent as though my body and mind did not exist at all. Whereupon, I composed the following stanza. And this is the verse he wrote. Suddenly, the violence of mind stops. Inner body, outer world, both are transparently clear after the great overturn. The great voidness is broken through. Oh, how freely the myriad manifestations come and go. Suddenly, the violence of mind stops. From then on, both the inward and the outward experience became lucidly clear. Sounds, voices, visions, scenes, forms, and objects were no longer hindrances. All my former doubts dissolved into nothing. When I returned to my kitchen, I found the cauldron covered with dust. Many days had passed without my knowing it. So these are some pretty dramatic, deep states that Hanshan got into. He must have had an extraordinary power of concentration. It seems that the predictions of these his early teachers who saw him as a child and said this is no ordinary child were valid enough. In the summer of that year, Xuan Lang came from the north to visit me, but he stayed only one day because he could not stand the cold and gloom of my isolated hermitage. In October of 1576, my patron, Mr. Hu, invited me to stay at his house. Patron, these monks, they often had to rely on the donations of a patron. They'd find a wealthy or somewhat wealthy man and rely on him to provide for food and clothing. He invited me to stay at his house. His friend, Mr. Cao, asked me to write a poem for him. I replied, "There is not a single word in my heart now. How can I write you a poem?" However, both he and Mr. Hu earnestly entreated me to write a poem. After their repeated insistences, I could not refuse. What's that saying? The man who pays the piper calls the tune? I then glanced over some old and contemporary books of poetry to stimulate my thought. In casually turning over the pages, my mind suddenly became keyed to inspiration. Verse poured from me, so that a few minutes later, when Mr. Hu returned, I had written some 20 poems. Suddenly I became aware of the danger in this and warned myself. "Watch out! This is just what that devil in words, your habitual thought, is doing to you." Immediately I stopped writing. I gave one of the poems to Mr. Cao and kept the rest of them secret. Nevertheless, I could not seem to stop the creative outflow I had started. It was as though all the poems, books, or sayings I had ever learned or seen in my life appeared simultaneously before me, cramming the space and air. Even had I had thousands of mouths all over my body, I could not have exhausted the word flow. This used to happen to me early in my training. I would go with very little sleep during sesshins, and late in sesshin, when I lay down, there was this din. It sounded exactly like that, like just hundreds of people in my head and with a conversation. It was like Robert Altman movie on steroids. Everyone talking over everyone else. I've often wondered how common that experience is. Anyway. Of course, I recognize it as a makyo, and I haven't had it for many years, but I think it was the result of just extraordinarily hard work on mu and a lot of sleep deprivation. And then In this, I'm going to summarize the next paragraph. It's because it's just a lot of material here. But basically, he decided that he recognized this from what this other master, Fa Kuang, had called Zen sickness. And he recognized that he was right in the middle of it. And there was no one there to help him with it, to beat him out of it. So he said, he decided he would just sleep as long and soundly as he could. And did he ever? He slept for days without waking up. And then says the servant boy knocked on the door and couldn't awake him. And they finally got in through the window, and they tried shaking him, and they still couldn't wake him. And then finally they rang a little bell in his ear again and again and again and again and again and again. And finally, gradually, he came to and was told to his amazement that he had been sleeping for 5 days. "Why, I thought only a single breath of time had passed," he said. "I sat silently and began to observe my surroundings, still not sure where I was. I then recalled my past experiences, and both they and the present ones seemed like events in a dream, no longer attainable or available. Whatever had troubled me had vanished like rain clouds before a clear sky. All space seemed as clear and transparent as if it had just been thoroughly washed." This is, many of you, I would guess, have had inklings of this after a 7-day sesshin. Maybe not this profoundly, but doesn't it resonate with how we feel after a 7-day sesshin? "All images and shadows dropped away into the great, all-tranquil voidness. My mind was so empty, the world so serene, my joy so great that words could not describe it." I then composed the following poem. And this is the verse: "When perfect stillness reigns, true illumination is reached. Since serene reflection includes all space, I can look back on the world again, which is filled with nothing but dreams. Oh, today I really understand how true and how faithful is the teaching of the Buddha." Even short of this kind of marvelous experience, we can come to see in the course of sesshin how unreal our thoughts and fantasies are, or we come to see them as less real, certainly, as the days pass. We get some distance from them. We are able to see that they have a kind of life of their own, these thoughts and fantasies, and that we do have a choice as to whether we engage with them. We can come to see them as a kind of a play or a film, a movie that's happening. That's detachment, where we're not caught up in it. We're not in the movie. We're suddenly realizing that that's a kind of a force of mind that has a kind of momentum to it that we don't have to perpetuate, and that by staying with just our practice, remaining single-mindedly absorbed in our practice, that this whole circus in our mind of stories and thoughts and everything else, that we can detach from all that, and that reveals a different world. A whole different world of stillness. A world that is at rest, a mind at rest. Such a relief. It's such a new vista that opens up when we begin to detach from these thoughts. Take one more paragraph here. When I was 34 years old, I devoted myself to copying the sutras. This was a real common, very respected practice in ancient China. Sometimes they would copy the sutras in their own blood, but it doesn't mention that. It is copying the sutras. During this work, on every stroke of the character and on every mark of punctuation, I recited the Buddha's name once. You can see how it's the Zen here. This just Chan is all interwoven with other kinds of Buddhist practice. Whenever monks or laymen visited me in the temple, I would talk with them while carrying on my work of copying. If anyone asked a question, I answered without hesitation. Yet my work was never hindered, nor did I make any mistakes in copying because of conversation. I did this every day as a routine, for not a trace of activity or quietness existed in my mind. He reports that the neighbors were skeptical about it, and they sent many people to visit him and do things purposely to distract him. He says, after this visit, I showed the copy to them. When they found not a single mistake in it, they were all convinced. They asked Miao Feng about my accomplishment. Miao Feng said, "Oh, this is nothing. It is simply because my friend is well acquainted with this particular samadhi. That is all." Here, too, you can, I think many people who've been to Sesshin can get a sense of this, have had a faint experience of something like this, again, late in Sesshin, when one's functioning flows in a way that is, it can be just quite amazing. It's then that we realize that our ordinary functioning, that we've kind of functioning we've done all of our life is to an amazing degree, it's all gummed up with our thoughts. Because when the mind is relatively free of thoughts, and even short of this kind of amazing samadhi, when our mind is more free of thoughts, there is this fluidity to our functioning, our work, our speech. It's when we realize that what we think of as normal, our normal activity, is really so clogged with thoughts. Well, time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.